You are listening to Wells Tech, episode 569, recorded on October 2nd, 2018. Getting excited about policies. Wells Tech is a weekly podcast exploring the intersections of technology and ministry. It is part of the podcast network sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Our show today is hosted by Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. This week we are exploring the topic of policies, mostly policies around privacy and security. We'll be going through a presentation about that and looking at privacy policies, information security policies, end user security policies, all that, a little talk about Amazon, Google, and a whole lot more. Welcome back again, everybody, and welcome to you, Sally. How are you today?
I am great. I'm watching a barge float by on the Mississippi River, so in a very unique camping location.
Nice. And you are in the great state of Tennessee, right?
Actually not. I'm in the great state of Arkansas, right across the river from the great state of Tennessee.
Oh, no kidding.
See Tennessee from here. But yeah, the campground that we're staying at is in West Memphis, Arkansas. But we're exploring the Memphis area. Had the pleasure of attending church at Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Memphis, Tennessee. And my goodness, those people are welcoming souls. And we just felt right at home there. It was a great, great worship experience.
Well, I believe our co-worker today in the Synod office, Kurt Lunenberg, used to be pastor there a long time ago, in fact. So,
yeah, he actually made a comment on my post that they were wonderful saints there in Memphis. So
nice.
Yep.
Glad you're getting to experience all that. That's neat. And right on the banks of the Mississippi, that's kind of special, too. So one of those perks you get.
Very unique.
All right, very good. Well, it's on those banks of the Mississippi that we're going to talk about actually a very important topic today. While it may not be the most glorious or exciting, we'll try and make it as much as we can. We're going to be talking about privacy and specifically a new regulation that came to us from our friends across the pond in the European Union. It's called GDPR, and lest you think it doesn't have anything to do with us in the 50 states here, United States, it actually does, and it does have some ramifications for anybody, really, who holds data. So we're going to broaden the scope and talk just about policies in general, security policies in general. And then we're going to, next week, continue the discussion and talk a little bit more about some of the technical things that you can do to protect not just your data, but protect the rights of the data of the people that you store in that database. So be a couple interesting weeks of dialogue, I think, Sally.
You know, Martin, I think it's really great that we are tackling this. This is kind of a tough topic and one that I'm not sure churches and schools maybe understand that they clearly need to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we've heard the term GDPR in the news a little bit. Maybe we all got flooded with those privacy statements via email around the end of May of this year, because that's when GDPR went into effect. But it's a pretty big topic and one that we shouldn't take lightly, I believe.
So hopefully we'll shed a little bit of light on it, as well as just privacy in general and security in general. What we've been doing here in the center office is putting together some security awareness training seminars. We've had a couple of those, and I'm going to share with our listeners the PowerPoint that we have been using for that those educational segments, and actually go through a few of the slides to give us at least a high-level view of what we're talking about here. I think it'll be a good foundation for our discussion. So we'll make that available, and let's talk about a couple of the maybe more important pieces of information that were shared that are applicable to our churches and our schools and our other WELLS organizations. One thing that I started to talk about with, you know, during the training was kind of the changing security landscape that we're undergoing right now over the past few years. You don't have to look too far to hear about all the security concerns and privacy concerns that are coming out of places like Facebook and Twitter and Apple and whatever. It's really a big deal, and it's becoming a political one as well, as a lot of legislation is hitting the books about how to treat data and how not to treat data, both foreign and domestic governmental restrictions. California just passed something pretty similar to GDPR, which is somewhat restrictive on what you can and can't do with data and what you have to do if somebody asks for their data back or asks to be forgotten. A couple other reasons why I think the landscape is changing, the security landscape is changing a bit, is that we are becoming some prime targets. Small to medium-sized businesses have data that I think hackers, phishers, whatever, would like to have, just no less than larger targets like Sony or Target or whoever. And we actually are a little bit more attractive because we probably have less resources to apply to the safeguarding of that data. Some of us don't have full-time security people, or even very knowledgeable, and that's maybe one of the reasons this is a topic. We're also seeing, Sally, I think, on our home shores here on the Synod front, an increased number of attacks, phishing attacks, malware attacks, viruses, those kinds of things, all at getting at the digital assets, and most of those assets that we have, information assets, are digital from the get-go now. People want access to those. So it's important to recognize that we're in a different world today than we were just a couple years ago.
Right. And I know a lot of our focus is always at a synod level, but I think everything you just said certainly applies to churches and schools, especially the part about not having dedicated security personnel watching right. out for the data. So that means that we as employees in churches and schools, or even the volunteers who are involved in touching various aspects of our database, information about our members, about our school families, whatever it may be, we have to be extra sensitive to this and aware, especially of the types of attacks that are out there.
Right. So as maybe odd as this may sound, where you actually need to start is with written documents, policies, if you will. And there are three key ones, I think, that are important to have these days. You mentioned one already, Sally, a privacy policy. A lot of those emails that we received back in May were for updated privacy policies. And we still see it today when you go to a site. If you haven't visited it before, it's likely that you may get a little note pop up that says, hey, we've got a privacy policy. You're agreeing to it by visiting our site. So that is one document, and I wish I had a great one to share with you, but we're working on ours right now, and as soon as ours is kind of blessed by our legal counsel, you'll actually be able to go to WELLS.net and see what we're using as a privacy policy and maybe use pieces of that for your own. If our listeners maybe have their own that they've worked on, and I'm sure there are some new ones out there, please feel free to share with the class. But a privacy policy basically tells a site visitor or anybody using your digital assets, it could be a digital form, it could be, you know, any kind of resource that you're making available for somebody's use. It basically tells them what the information is for, and if you're collecting information, what you're going to do with that collected information and how you're going to treat it, what rights they have by giving you that information. So that's a privacy policy. That's where I would start, because that really kind of lays the groundwork for everything else. And then there are two other policies that are super important to have, at least in my opinion. One is what we call an information security policy, and that lets all your employees, all your volunteers, anybody who handles your data, so that could be a church secretary, school secretary, pastor, teacher, school volunteer, any of those types, or any of your third-party vendors who have access to your information. It basically lays the groundwork for how they have to protect that information. What information is confidential, what they can give out, what they can't, what's public, what's not, and then some of the ramifications for not paying attention to or not agreeing to or not abiding by the prescripts of that information security policy. So it defines your data. It says what you can do with it, what you can't do with it. Basically, it's a policy that really needs to be in place for your protection, but also for the protection of the data of those who have entrusted it to you. And trust really is a big thing here, because it's really a bad day when you have to tell your members or your donors or people that are supporters of your organization that you've lost their data. Not in the sense that you can't find it, although that maybe is the case sometimes if there are ransomware attacks, but the fact that somebody who should have their data now has their data. So that's policy number two. And then policy number three has more to do with the practices that you need to put in place to physically protect the data. So how to create a strong password, what are your password rules, where to store data, where not to store data, what computers you can use, what kind of encryption should be on those computers, how long the computer can stay unlocked before itself locks. Those kinds of things are all in this end-user security policy. Can you use a phone? When you're using a phone, can you attach or get emails from the organization or look up donor information or congregation member information or student information? All of that goes in your end-user security policy. So those are the big three policies, I think, that are necessary in almost every organization.
A couple of things that strike me as you're describing those, Martin. First of all, that information security policy, I would guess that's, well, probably all three of these. These aren't a once-and-done kind of policy effort. They're going to change over time, and your data might grow or whatever and need to be reevaluated as to the wording that you use to describe all your different data pieces and things. So I would guess, yep, you need these, and if you don't have them, then work towards getting them in place, but also consider it something that you have to have ongoing updates to or review of, at least,
right,
to see if they need to be updated.
That's a great point, because that's exactly what happened to our information security policy. I'm in the process of revising it because of GDPR, because the way we treated information has to change based on governmental regulation. So that would be an example. If, for instance, you started a school or a preschool, now you fall under some more regulations that you didn't necessarily have to pay attention to if you were just a standalone congregation. These are living, liquid documents that need to be examined. Maybe an important point here that maybe goes without saying, but maybe not. Education needs to happen. Just the fact that you have policies is not enough. Those people to whom the policies apply need to read them regularly and agree to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess that part of it is the part that's probably the hardest of all this, even though drafting all that language has got to be really hard, and I don't envy you a bit for all the work you've done. But it's kind of like the floodgates were open, and we were just loosey-goosey and used to, we can ask you for information and we can do whatever we want to with it, or we're trustworthy, we'll use it appropriately, and maybe we aren't as secure as we need to be or whatever. It's really hard now to kind of tighten things up and say you can't ask for things unless you're really guarding it correctly and deleting it when you're done with it and things like that. So a lot of people probably would rather just not deal with this, but unfortunately, the day and age we live in and the fact that the European Union has passed this is just the tip of the iceberg, most likely.
Right.
We're going to have a lot more.
And that's kind of the guidance we're giving all of our users as well, because we're going to talk about what GDPR is here in a second, what it is, but it only applies to European Union residents. And you may say, well, that doesn't affect us. But as I said, you know, that's coming to our shores as well. There are different states with legislation in the works or on the books, even in the case of California, where similar restrictions are being placed on how we protect the data, how we can or can't share the data. So it's actually very important that we kind of treat this now versus kind of being behind the curve and then something bad happens. So. Mm-hmm. So what is GDPR? And then I'm going to come back to a very important definition about what we call personal data. So GDPR is known as the General Data Protection Regulation. It's a European Union law, as I mentioned, and it went into effect last May. And it covers any entity which collects, processes, or stores the personal data of any resident of the EU. Now, that may or may not include some of our listeners, because you might be surprised what information you have in your databases. So if you had a member that now has since moved to a European Union state, then this actually applies to you, because you have information about a European Union resident in your database. So everything that we're going to talk about how to protect the database, you know, sharing of information, et cetera, really does apply because you're maintaining this data. But even at that, even if you didn't, these are just good guidelines and things that we should probably have in place in anticipation of tighter restrictions on privacy. And then, of course, failure to comply has its own ramifications. Then this personal data definition thing, how does the GDPR protect personal data? Well, it requires any organization who collects, processes, or stores that data to ensure that we properly secure, obviously, the people's personal information. We maintain and follow a clear data protection policy. So getting back to those policies that need to be in place, and if you don't have any, it's kind of hard to maintain and follow them, and then provide notification in the event of a breach. And we're going to get more into notification next week. But this personal information that you have needs to, you know, be treated with kid gloves to a certain degree, and I'm not sure that we're always doing that. So the natural question, Sally, is, well, what is personal data? And that definition has kind of changed over time now that GDPR is in place. So personal information is defined as any information which can be used to identify a particular individual, such as name, ID numbers, address, email, phone, location data, medical information, economic, cultural, or social identifiers, religious affiliation. All those are considered now personal data and would fall under this Protection Act. So that's actually pretty broad and far-ranging, and really that's a definition that includes almost all the information we collect about our members, our school kids, our school parents, our donors, our supporters, family members. Basically, it's the whole ball of wax.
That's kind of overwhelming, Martin, let me just say. And I really don't want to be out of compliance. So what kind of problems am I going to get into if I am?
Well, there are fines up to 20% of revenue.
Wow.
Is the max. So for anybody, losing 20% of an annual revenue is pretty significant. But as I mentioned at the top of the show, I think, or when we first started talking about this, I think the bigger ramification would be just the loss of trust. So if you have to notify your members, donors, volunteers that you've lost their information, you weren't as careful with it as the law requires, or that they would like you to be even, that could mean a drop in offerings, a drop in membership, all kinds of negative negative impressions that an organization would have to suffer through and regain over time. And the thing about it is prevention and applying some of these policies, getting these policies in place and providing some of these technical protections isn't all that difficult. So there really isn't an excuse. It may take a little diligence, but it's important to get ahead of this and make sure that that loss of trust doesn't happen.
Well, I'm motivated. I think our listeners would be as well. So we'll definitely want to continue this discussion next week and look at ways that you can notify people and keep your data protected and all of those kind of things.
So we're going to try and provide as many resources as possible. Like I mentioned, we'll provide this PowerPoint that we're using. And a little bit later under Ministry Resources, we'll give you a sample of one of them as well, one of the policies. So get that to look forward to.
Good stuff. And maybe go ahead and clue those other employees and volunteers in your organization into this. You certainly could probably, I think, download the PowerPoint from the link that we're providing if you want to modify it and present the same thing in your congregation or school. That certainly would be a good place to start.
Very good. Should we move on to news and tech, Sally?
Sure. I came across a couple of newsy things that I thought were interesting and worth sharing. The first of which was an article from Forbes magazine. A couple of financial-type magazines and news outlets were reporting last week that Amazon made an announcement about something they call Amazon Go. And apparently Amazon Go has been in beta for several years now, so not a brand-new concept, but something I personally hadn't heard of. And it basically is a cashierless shopping experience. So imagine stopping at the 7-Eleven or whatever, your local convenience store, the Quick Trip nearby, and going in. As you walk in the door, you scan an app on a scanner near the door. You have your shopping bag. You walk around and take things off of the shelf, put them in your bag, and walk out the door without checking out. And that's the whole idea behind these Amazon Go stores, that they don't require you to check out. They know what you're taking off the shelf and putting in your bag, and they automatically charge you for it. And they even go as far to say as if you take it off the shelf and then you go back and put it back, they won't charge you for it. So smart shopping, some really smart shopping involved there, and something they've been testing, I think, in the Seattle market for some period of time. The big announcement last week was that by 2021, it's their goal, Amazon's goal, to have 3,000 of these Amazon Go convenience type stores nationwide. That's pretty big. I'm guessing that somewhere along the line, all of us will be near one of 3,000 stores nationwide. And so basically, Amazon is driving our future in terms of this cashierless shopping experience. And that's really what the article was focused on. What does this mean for retail in general? Will there be larger stores, grocery stores and things in the future that have the same kind of methodology in play? And, you know, what's life going to look like and what kind of economic impact is it going to have? So just some interesting things to contemplate. The article is certainly well written and just something new to envision about our not too distant future, apparently.
One of the interesting points the article makes is the pressure this is going to put on other retailers, supermarkets, mm-hmm. convenience stores, the Walgreens, the CVSs, other retailers, where they're suggesting, and I believe this, consumers aren't going to have the patience to go through kind of the typical wait, at some of these places that we frequent fairly often because of the convenience of these. And chances are, if there's 3,000 of these, by, did you say 2021?
Yep.
There's going to be one near you, pretty much. And so the experience, I guess maybe the biggest question I would have would be, will it have the things that I want, that I need? Mm-hmm. What's going to be on the shelf? Is it going to be kind of that one-stop shop? Or will the novelty wear off when I recognize that either the price isn't what I want it to be, or it doesn't have the things, it doesn't have the convenience of all the things that I want. So, but that's an interesting concept, and I'm sure they'll figure that out through technology as well, right?
Right.
If you have a way to get feedback back to them, or they recognize that they are short in an area or need to beef up another area. I wonder how big these stores would be as well. That might be an interesting question to find out.
Yeah. And some of the article gets into a little bit about how their systems were overwhelmed by larger volumes of shoppers and larger quantities of items and things. But the whole point is, they'll figure it out. It's mm-hmm. on our horizon. It's coming. And, you know, I can remember our local Walmart in New Ulm used to have all regular cashier lines. And one day they renovated and all of a sudden we had this scan and go kind of area where you check yourself out. And now I see those in more and more stores. Now, as I'm traveling, I'm seeing more and more stores with like right up front, big kiosk and lockers and things where it's the site to store, where you can get anything you want delivered to the store. So you just go in and, you know, you've already paid for it. You scan an app or whatever and pick up your items. So all of those things are leading to this cashierless systems, you know, in just different ways. So
very competitive space. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yep. For sure.
All right. Go ahead.
I was just going to say one more news and tech item, if I'm allowed to insert one more. Just a fun thing from Google. I believe maybe it was last Friday that they had a special Google Doodle because it was their 20th anniversary of Google in the United States. And so there's just a little video that they made that I thought was really interesting to kind of look back over search over the last 20 years and some of the more popular search terms over that time. They do a really good representation of it, including the original Google screen and people typing, "What is Google?" Because we didn't even know the term Google 20 years ago. And now it's so much a part of our lives to rely on the Google search engine capabilities. So if you're interested, head over to wellstech.wells.net and you can watch that video and have a little nostalgia over the last 20 years of Google searches.
It's been 20 years. I remember where I was when I first heard about Google, because up until that time, it was things like whatever was built into CompuServe or whatever, but the original search engines like Alta Vista, you know, if mm-hmm. you remember those, you know, Yahoo, you know, were mm-hmm. out there, were kind of list-driven or, you know, curated lists, and they weren't super helpful. And then when Google came on the scene, they kind of threw the doors open and shocked everybody with this just one little box, you know, this super mm-hmm. clean interface and, you know, and smart search results. I was working for a startup whose headquarters was in New York, and I was out in New York for a week of meetings, and our digital strategist, one of our digital strategists, mentioned it to me, and I thought, boy, that is a really funny sounding name. That'll never catch on. That just sounds too stupid.
Yeah. You should have bought stock instead.
I know. Lo and behold, they're massive. So interesting.
Yeah, cool stuff.
Let's move on to Wells Now.
And just want to make mention of a outreach effort. Initiative that's underway from our congregational services area. It's called C18. It stands for Christmas 2018, and a synod-wide program to reach 1 million souls. Christmas season is probably the time that you have the most visitors in your congregation, and they're hoping on Christmas Eve that Wells as a whole can reach out to 1 million souls. And what they've done is they've developed a whole ton of amazing resources to help you this Christmas season. And it's all housed over at a new site, wellscongregationalservices.net/C18. And you can actually sign up for a newsletter, and they'll be releasing more and more of these resources over time. So the newsletter will tell you anytime something new is released. They've organized it into different areas, including schools resources, congregational counseling resources, special ministries, discipleship, so different Bible studies and things, certainly evangelism resources, worship resources. I took a peek at the worship resources, and they have gathering rites and bulletin covers and just tons and tons of things around the worship services during Advent, during the actual Christmas season for Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, etc. And then just general promotional materials, door hangers, and a postcard that's available. And the postcard, I think, can be ordered with a discount for the first 200 congregations that order the postcard, $150 credit to your bill for those first 200 organizations, congregations that order. So you definitely want to dig in. I can tell from the download counts that these resources are getting used already. Over 800 downloads of the worship resources already. Things like your one-day Advent for kids program is out there. Lots and lots of good stuff. So if you haven't found it yet, definitely head over to wellscongregationalservices.net/C18. We'll have the link in the show notes and take advantage of the great resources that are being shared there. Be part of the 1 million who worship in Wells congregations this Christmas.
Now is the time. So actually, time is going to be here before we know it. So
it's true. Fourth quarter.
Excellent resources. So take advantage of those. Sally, I think it's time for our picks of the week.
All righty. And my pick of the week centers around one of my favorite tools, and that is Gmail. I use Gmail for my personal email service, and boy, do I have a lot stored in there. And I'm always trying to be efficient and use it to its maximum capabilities because there's so much it will do for you. Found an article recently in Computer World titled "How to Make Gmail's Desktop Interface Infinitely Better." Now, I'm all about infinitely better. That sounds like a good idea to me. And they gave some real simple tips and some that I've already implemented in my own Gmail inbox interface. One of the main things that they talk about is making use of keyboard shortcuts. So if you didn't know this, you can actually type as long as your keyboard shortcuts are turned on in settings. So it's on the general tab of settings where you can turn on or off your keyboard shortcuts. But if they're turned on, you can just type a question mark and the keyboard shortcuts will display on the screen. Just commit some of those to memory and your whole Gmail experience will be a lot more fast and efficient. So, example, you hit the C key whenever you want to compose a email or whatever. So, the other thing that they mentioned was the biggie for me, and that's condensing the left side panel. So if you're familiar with Gmail, typically your folder list runs down the left side, and it can get long and ugly. And I don't really need to see it all the time, what all my folders are. If I want to go there, that's great. But most of the time, I want to deal with the contents in my inbox, which is the main star of the screen. And so basically, by clicking on the hamburger icon, it's three bars. It's up by the Gmail logo in the upper left part of the screen. If you click on that, it'll dock all of those things in your left sidebar into a condensed icon-driven sidebar. And you can either hover to see the items that the icons represent, or you can click the hamburger icon again to unlock and show that that left sidebar. So it's basically a toggle of hiding it away or showing it with that hamburger icon in the upper left-hand corner. And that was pretty huge for me. But beyond that, one thing that is available is something called a more drop-down. So they'll show you a certain number of your folders, and then they'll tuck the rest of them away under more. And you can expand that more just by clicking on the word more. You'll see everything else, and it says less after that. But I didn't know that you could actually drag and drop things above and below that breakpoint of more or less, and it'll move things down so that they can be locked away or hidden in the more menu. So I realized right away that I wanted to hide some of those things because I'm always looking for a particular folder that's near the end of the list, and I don't use all those others that are higher up in the list. So I just grabbed the folder name and drug it down below, and it was hidden away in the more menu. And so my menu of folders is a whole lot shorter now, and it's just limited to the ones that I use all the time. If that didn't make sense to you, my great description there, then I really encourage you to check out this article because they walk you through it and show you screenshots and things like that. There are other tips in the article that may be a benefit to you as well. Again, it's called How to Make Gmail's Desktop Infinitely Better. So if you're a Gmail user, I'd encourage you to give it a quick read.
Neat. I was reading the article, and one thing that grabbed my attention was number 5, using a Chrome plugin called StyleBot. And this thing is really cool. This allows you to add the extension, and basically you can hide or modify different things on these pages that you do or don't want to see, or you can resize them. You can really customize almost any web page that uses CSS, which is all of them. So if you want to get rid of a sidebar, or if you want to get rid of a footer or header or a big logo or whatever, StyleBot lets you do that. I'm thinking that there are a lot of kind of go-to sites that we use day in and day out that you could really tweak and optimize for your pleasure. This is actually very cool. I didn't know this was possible. This is awesome. So StyleBot, awesome. I'm going to try that.
Good thing.
All right. My tip of the week actually came from somebody who contributed to the show, saw an old show we did on privacy, maybe it was on copyright or both. And they said, well, had you seen, and they're part of this organization, the staysafe.org site. So I promised her that I would bring it up on the show, and I thought so highly of the page that she forwarded that I wanted to make it my pick of the week. It's staysafe.org/teens. And they have other resources here, but I thought this page was really super well done. Online Teen Safety Guide. And they go through all kinds of things that you ought to be aware of in talking to your... So if you have a teen, I would really highly encourage you to read this article. It's a pretty lengthy article, really well done, really well organized. It kind of goes from the basics, from setting up password protection to turning on the locator to discussing sensitive information, malware, viruses, spyware, definitions for all that, how to protect mobile hardware, identity theft, scams, and online shopping that are so prevalent today. Then, of course, it goes into social media. Gives definitions for things that you as a parent may not be aware of that exists, stalking and predators, then it gets into bullying, gaming, all kinds of great topics. Should my teen have a blog? Just kind of a common sense, very complete guidelines for working with your teen about how keeping them safe online. It's from the National Home Security Alliance. I don't know really anything about them other than they wrote a super article here. So that's my pick of the week, staysafe.org/teens. I think this would be great material to go through in our Erie Lutheran high schools or maybe even upper grades in our elementary schools. So good stuff.
Yeah, excellent find there. Worthy of lots of sharing, and hopefully parents especially will pay attention and, yep, and share the information with their teens.
Mm-hmm. I think it's time to move on to our ministry resource, and I gave this a little tease, Sally, at the beginning or toward the end of our opening discussion. What I've posted is a sample information security policy. And that'll be our ministry resource for the day. And essentially what I did is I took our current information security policy at the synod level, and I cleaned it up and made it kind of a template, you know, a sample template for anybody to pull down and make their own. Now, it does apply to, I would think, organizations like a church or a school or other religious organization. But again, you're going to want to modify it to match your certain circumstances. But it does have the basic key categories, including a couple of appendices that I think are important for every organization to have. One is an appendix that you would ask your employees or volunteers to sign. So they're going to read and they're going to agree to abiding by the principles and the guidelines in the information security policy. I'm going to do this, I'm not going to do this, et cetera. The other appendix is a document that could be used, a legal document that could be used when you are working with third parties who are taking your information and doing something with it, storing it, analyzing it, those kinds of things. So anybody that would also have access to the information that you want to protect, you'd want them to read this document and agree to its policies and principles as well. So I thought we'd throw it out there as a ministry resource this week, sample information security policy. It's in Word doc format, and most everybody can open that in some way, shape, or form. If you open it in Google Docs, you'll be able to convert it to Google Doc format if that's your platform of choice.
Good stuff. Thanks for sharing, and hopefully that gets folks at least a starting point towards putting some of those important policies in place.
I thought you were going to say get them excited about privacy and policy creation, but that would be a little overstep. But
yeah, I think that would be a stretch.
It does save you a step. Let's get excited about that part of it. So
there you go.
Let's move on to community feedback.
And we've had some discussion over on the Wells Tech Google group. This is the place you can go to ask your techie questions. Of a good number of your techie Wells friends or virtual friends. And recently, Theodore Kufall posted about productivity platforms, finding the right tool to do all the things that he wants it to be able to do. And interesting discussion ensued. You know, I think we all have our vision of what we want our tools to do for us, and maybe they do everything but, you know, a few of the things. They don't always meet all our expectations, but people kind of encouraged Theodore to try some different things and, you know, zero in on what his number one priorities were, things like that. There was also encouragement to look again at the Apple Reminders and Notes capabilities, as well as Google Keep and the capabilities in the Google ecosystem for keeping track of lists and things to do and sharing and things like that. So good conversation, and kudos to the Wells Tech Google group for always coming through with great feedback when people ask questions and things.
One thing I wanted to bring up, I saw Bob Martins chime in here talking about reminders, as you mentioned. I ran across a great kind of front end to reminders. Reminders is actually very basic. It's just a list, you know, multiple lists, and it can remind you when you get to certain locations or at different times of the day or, you know, those kinds of things. But it doesn't have any real prioritization, sorting, connecting of tasks, those kinds of things. So one kind of cool, and I'm not going to make this a pick because I haven't used it extensively, but one that I've heard really good things about is something called Good Task. But what it basically does is it's not a task manager in and of itself, but it's kind of a front end to reminders. So it's an iOS app. So you get it, and it's not free. I think you can use it for free for a little bit, then you have to pay for it, but it's not a lot. But it works really well. I tried it for a little bit just to kind of kick the tires and see how it worked. But so it uses reminders, and reminders has all the good syncing stuff. So you can go from your iPad to your iPhone to your Mac if you have a Mac. Good Task actually puts a nice front end to it, gives you a lot more customization about creating priorities and task sharing and those kinds of things. So if you're interested in kind of taking reminders to the next level, but don't want a whole new task manager, Good Task might be one of those. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Good stuff. Thank you. A few mentions from the Wells Intersections group. That's a Facebook group that anyone can join and share different technology and ministry things. The man behind the screen is Pastor James Aderman, who does a great job of curating content and sharing it in the group specifically. But there's lots of people in the discussion and good place just to kind of stay on top of those things. And over in Wells Intersections, a couple of things worth noting. Someone shared a link to Dareful. I hadn't heard of Dareful.
Dareful.com,
Dareful. And they have free 4K stock video, super high quality stuff. You can go over there and click the link to view all their different video. And I would say there's a good 30 or so videos that they've shared. Many of them are aerial type flyovers of beautiful locations, a lot out in nature, some in the city, some are just bouquet kind of blurry images. They've got Christmas videos, they've got fireplace videos, all kinds of stuff, hot air balloons, just really high quality stuff. And if you read about it, it's basically a guy who enjoys creating great video footage and gives it away for free, 100% free. Download whatever you want, use it in all types of projects, including commercial, forever. We never ask for a credit card, just sign up and start downloading. And the man's name is Joel Holland. He's also the founder of something called Video Blocks. And this Dareful site is a part of Video Blocks. And it says that Joel thinks high-quality stock footage should be accessible to everyone, not just big-budget studios. With Dareful, he wants passionate video hobbyists and enthusiasts to get the best of his personal content completely free before it becomes full price for the rest of the world. So he's got a picture of himself in a very remote location in some kind of dune buggy type contraption where he's come to this summit of a mountain area and he's holding a drone. Obviously, a lot of the video footage is from drone camera work. His only request is that you give him attribution. So it is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. And they're always adding new stuff. But, you know, Martin, I thought this kind of footage is becoming more popular on websites where you see, like, something in the background behind a big splash area of the site that's just got some motion to it, something subtle but lovely in the background of different web displays and things like that. So this might be a source for that for some of our listeners.
Yeah, I could think of a number of applications, not just for website, but also for, you know, during worship, pre-worship, classroom, be part of your presentation. Just kind of that moving background, subtle, because these are not, these are kind of slow, almost kind of slow motion, you know, flyover kinds of things. But high resolution, very nice.
Yeah, really nice. I was excited to find that one. Also from the Wells Intersections group, there was a link to an infographic. We posted it on Pinterest, so we'll include a link in the show notes. It's titled The 100 Best Website Design Tools Ever. Ever is a big deal. And
it's a long time.
It is. They've organized it into different types of tools like typography, stock photos, stock graphics, infographics, collaboration, colors, inspiration, etc. And there's definitely a lot of things on this list that I wasn't familiar with that I'm eager to check out. So for logo and design, for instance, they listed Designmatic and Logo Maker and Logoshi and Graphic Springs, and none of those had I heard of, but maybe they're a place to go and look at different logo design possibilities. So definitely worth exploring, especially if you're stuck creatively and looking for some new ideas or new tools to work with. There's one section labeled Inspiration. And the number one that they outlined or featured in that section is called Dribble. I never heard of Dribble. It has three B's in it if you're trying to spell it. But anyway, the place where designers share their most dazzling assets, dribble.com. So yeah, go and explore some new things using this infographic and the leads that are posted there.
Very nice. Yeah, I noticed it's a couple years old, so there's some of these may not be around anymore, but this is a lot of inspiration here. Just take an afternoon or whatever and click around and see what's out there. And they do clearly say which ones are fee and which ones are free. There's a little dollar sign in front of those that cost something.
Cool. And a couple of years old shouldn't matter if it says ever.
That's true.
Web design tools ever.
Right. Plus, it's on Pinterest. That must be true.
There you go. All right. Finally, a conversation worth mentioning in the Wells Google Schools group. Jason Potosky posted some questions about how schools handle posting pictures of students at various activities. And many people responded that they get permission during the registration process. They have a form and an acceptable use policy and things like that. Actually, teacher Mike Plucker from St. Paul's in New Ulm shared examples of publicity release and FERPA forms that are part of their registration process. So you have to head over to Wells Google Schools. That's a private community on Google Plus, but certainly worth becoming part of that community for all the great information that's shared there.
Very nice. So, Sally, if someone were of a mind to contribute to the show, is there a way for them to do that?
Let's see. Yes, there is. Lucky day. There are many ways for them to do that. They can pick their favorite. Certainly, they can communicate with us via different social media channels. We're on Google+, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram, and oftentimes you can find us just by searching Wells Tech. But we have a website, wellstech.wells.net, where all our shows are archived, and you can certainly add comments to particular shows of interest there. There's a place on the website to send us voicemail, and there's even links to send us good old-fashioned email, wellstech@wells.net. So please do join the conversation.
Love to hear from you. Yep. And Sally, we have a video of the week from Amazon, don't we?
Yep. Circling back to the discussion of news and tech, if you'd like to get a feel for what an Amazon Go store is like, where you walk in, pick it up, put it in your bag, and walk out without paying, there's a video that demonstrates it, the Amazon Go concept. So check out our video of the week for more of a vision of what that shopping experience would be like.
To a corner somewhere near you, I'm sure, pretty soon.
Seems that way.
All right, next week we are going to do this all over again, show 570, and it's GDPR, or privacy policy, or just policies, etc., part two. And we're going to get a little bit more practical, although it's hard to get more practical than a good old-fashioned policy, but we're going to look at the technical side. If you've ever created a form and collected information, you probably need to tune in because things are changing and you're going to have to do things a little bit differently when you collect that information, or you should do things a little bit differently when you collect that information from those that are filling out your form. So that and more coming up next week. Sally, you can go back to watching those barges roll past. Hopefully, the sun is shining on you and you've got your lemonade or your iced tea.
iced tea.
And you feed up, so we can all picture it. But happy that you decided to join us, despite all that, so for 569. And we're also happy that all of you decided to tune in one more time. And we really hope that you would do that again next week and bring a friend. Thanks for being here, and blessings on your week. We'll talk to you soon.